stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. We are live on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. For over 11 years now, we've been trying to answer your questions about the Catholic faith. Those of you who are not Catholic, please consider this a special resource just for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also email us, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski on a phone screening. Ace McKay's checking out social media, including YouTube and Facebook. If you have a question, you can certainly post your question there on the chat screen. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
Doing decent, thank you.
Interesting question here. This is from Jamie or Jaime, either one. Hello there. I just saw a YouTube video about a priest who was taken out of his diocese because he wrote a paper on allowing married men and women to be ordained as a way of to fix the shortage in the priesthood. I thought technically married men could be ordained. They just couldn't get married after being ordained or remarried in the case of a widower. So my question is, number one, am I wrong that married men can become priests? And number two, is no woman in the clergy a dogma of the church, like as in infallibly taught, or a small t tradition that could change in time? Thank you, Jamie.
Yeah, thanks very much. I appreciate the question. So you are correct, in part, you're correct that a married man can in principle be ordained to the priesthood, although there's a long-standing tradition in the Latin Church of resistance to doing that as a practical matter, and canon law that makes it impossible in most instances. The exceptions are rare. I mean, there are exceptions, and there are married Catholic priests, but that's not the normal state of things. And so advocating for a wholesale change of the church's discipline, for a priest to advocate that publicly is tantamount to saying that he thinks that the church has made a prudential error of judgment in its present policy and that they should change. And depending on how you phrase that, could be taken in a more or less respectful tone, and what is the venue in which he published it. And I mean, it's legitimate for people to talk about hypothetical possibilities and this sort of thing, but due respect to the Holy See, and consider your audience and what's the dignity or the position of the person making the suggestion. All that has to be taken into consideration when you consider the prudence of a kind of public intervention like that. With respect to women ordained to the clergy, whether the bishopric or the priesthood or the diaconate, it's a dogma of the church that cannot happen. That's a dogma of the church. Now, it isn't a dogma that's been defined by an act of the extraordinary magisterium, so the Pope has never issued an infallible dogmatic declaration to that effect, but the Pope has taught as part of his ordinary jurisdiction that it is in fact a revealed doctrine. Now, it's a fine distinction. So the position of the church is that the ordinary and universal magisterium of the church has consistently taught this doctrine for 2,000 years, and that is one of the organs of infallibility. Not everything has to be defined by a pope to be understood to be infallible.
Okay. Jamie, thank you so much for your email. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to begin today with Russ in Nashville. Hey there, Russ. What's on your mind today?
Hey, my question has to do with the final judgment. What do we know based on what the church or the saints have said about how that will work? And specifically in regards to works, like if they will play a part, how would that work? Is it like a scale, or what part would they be able to play?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question. So there are several passages in the New Testament that speak directly to the question of the final judgment. All of them say that there is only one thing upon which one's life will be judged. They're unanimous about this, and in every case, it's one's works. It's what one, in fact, does with one's life that is the basis for the judgment. Jesus actually explicitly rejects the idea that that anyone would be judged by the profession of faith. Matthew 25, he says, many people will come to me on that day and say, Lord, Lord, and I will say, I never knew you, because you didn't feed the hungry, clothe the naked, give drink to the thirsty, food to the hungry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the consistent teaching of the Bible.
Okay.
Is there a scale? Is there a checklist? No. So it's not like, you know, God is some celestial accountant, who has the impartial scales of justice, and he heaps all the good works over here and all the evil works over there, and then adds them up. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. So the church's teaching is that we can, through faith, we can be connected to God in grace. God can give us the gift of grace. And if we are in the state of God's grace, every good thing that we do acquires merit before God. So, you know, yes, all those works of mercy, but also fulfilling the duties of your state of life. So, you know, if you're a husband and a father, if you care for your children, love your wife, help your neighbors, I mean, whatever it is that you do in life, provided you're in the grace of God, is in itself meritorious. And so what if you were an infant? What if you leave the baptismal font in the state of grace? Well, you know, you're not going to be feeding a lot of hungry people or giving drink to a lot of thirsty people if you're an infant.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to say, wah, right? But believe it or not, if you say wah in the state of grace, you actually merit eternal life as an infant according to your state of life as an infant. You walk out of you're carried out of the baptismal font, having fully met all the demands of the divine law in virtue of being in the state of grace through baptism.
Okay. Russ, is that helpful for you?
Well, I'm just wondering, if that's the case, why do Protestants kind of levy the charge of, well, if you're thinking too much about your works, then, you know, you're going to become prideful, whereas I feel like the experience is like, well, if Christ and the saints are the model, right, like, that's not actually how it plays out. Like, it doesn't create pride. It creates, like, a distance that, you know, we're not there yet.
Right. So the Protestant charge is primarily not that this is pragmatically a bad idea because it induces pride. Their basic position is that no human act is intrinsically meritorious, even in the state of grace, that humans are sufficiently vitiated by sin that no matter what you do, even giving food to the hungry or you know, clothes to the naked, that it's vitiated by some sort of self-love or pride. And so whatever you do, even the best apparent good works are in fact hateful to God. That's the sort of standard Calvinist line of total depravity.
Russ, thanks for listening in Nashville. In a moment, we'll talk with Steve in Oklahoma City. Busy phones today, but not too busy for you. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Excuse me. We are live on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, and we have two lines open right now, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. In a moment, we'll get to Steve in Oklahoma City. Let me tell you about something beautiful available at EWTN's religious catalog. It is the National Life Rosary. You can turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary, designed exclusively for EWTN and for all of you listening and watching. The unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins, as we know, at conception. Help pray for and build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary. Do check it out. It's quite stunning, I think. Go to EWTNRC.com for that. EWTNRC.com. In the search bar, put in National Life Rosary. You'll see what I'm talking about. All right, back to the phones now for Steve in Oklahoma City, listening on the great Oklahoma Catholic Radio. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, thank you. Other than in regard to saints, purgatory, and the sacraments, would you say your version of justification is identical to that of Charles Stanley, at least in the majority of his sermons? And if not, would you please explain the difference? And I'm not asking about the sermons where he wears only a Protestant hat, unless you can tell us if those sermons are from a different time in his life when he had different beliefs.
Right. So I am not a particular fan of Charles Stanley, and so I have not spent a lot of time listening to his sermons. My understanding is that Stanley is a Baptist, and my expectation would be that his soteriology, his view of salvation, is takes the standard Baptist line, and if it's other than that, you'd have to let me know. So what I can tell you is what the Protestant and standard Protestant and standard Catholic doctrines are. Where Stanley lines up on that, I don't know, but I'd be shocked if he held the Catholic view and could still keep a pulpit, honestly. I mean, like, anybody that really believes the Catholic doctrine of salvation and stands up in a Baptist pulpit is going to lose his ordination, honestly, because this is the line on which the division between Protestants and Catholics stands. I mean, this is the issue of division. So the primary difference between Protestants and Catholics really doesn't boil down to the phrase faith alone. It really boils down to what we mean by the term justification. You know, St. Paul says a man's justified by faith and not by works of the law. What do you mean when you say justification? And the typical Protestant position is that justification means that God regards the individual as righteous regardless of the state of their moral life. Right? This is Luther's famous doctrine of simul justus et peccator, simultaneously just and a sinner, regarded by God as just, though remaining intrinsically sinful. And the the image from the Reformation era that's I learned in seminary and it continues to be bandied about is the dunghill covered in snow. Right? On the inside, you're a dunghill, but in appearance to God, you're lily white, because God imputes the righteousness of Christ to the believer. Right, so he regards the believer as if he had done the righteous things that Jesus had done. And in some versions of the story, God imputes the sins of Christians to Christ, so that God regards Christ as if he were a sinner, though he is actually intrinsically innocent, and therefore the cross is God punishing Christ for sins he did not commit. That's the doctrine of penal substitution.
Okay.
So that's kind of the standard Protestant line. Now, as soon as I say that, there's going to be some Protestant in the audience that says, that's not what I believe. And that's great. I'm glad you don't believe it. But that is what confessional Protestantism has typically held for 500 years. The Catholic Church believes that through faith, we receive a grace that does not involve the mere imputation of Christ's righteousness. It actually infuses Christ's righteousness so that the individual believer is in fact morally changed. They're moved from the state of an actual sinner to the state of an actually righteous person who loves God and loves neighbor effectively, so that God can say in justice and truth, not because Christ did these things, but because they are done in you, well done, good and faithful servant. Now, that takes place through the grace of Christ, which he merited on the cross, mm-hmm. but through a sort of different engineering, if you will. The metaphysics of the thing work out differently. Uh-huh. So that's the major difference. Now, once you acknowledge that, Protestants can say an awful lot of things that Catholics would completely agree with. I have yet to meet the Protestant that advocates for immorality. Right, they advocate for the moral life. They advocate for moral change. They advocate for holiness. They will advocate that these things are the fruit of salvation, that coming into a relationship with Christ does in fact morally change you. I mean, all these are standard Protestant positions. What they deny typically is that any of those changes are determinative for your eternal standing with God.
I see.
They're effects of one's relationship with God, but they are not the grounds of judgment upon which God determines whether or not to let you into heaven, right? There are other differences, but those are kind of the main differences. Now, I would be shocked if Charles Stanley rejected the doctrine of imputation. If he rejects imputation and he believes in infused righteousness, then he must do a good job of hiding that, because he would be universally denounced from Protestant pulpits all over the world if he taught that, right? And maybe he is, but I don't follow him that closely.
Steve, thanks so much for your phone call. We hope that's helpful for you. Thanks for checking in from Oklahoma City. Call to Communion here on EWTN. One line open, 833-288-EWTN. It can be all yours. 833-288-3986. Here is Elizabeth now in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hey there, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I'd like to know if you'd recommend the book Paradise Lost, and if so, which version?
Yeah, thank you so much. I would recommend Paradise Lost as a work of English literature. I would not recommend it as a work of theology. So that's the position that I would take. Milton is one of the greatest English poets of all time, and I would read Milton the way I would read John Donne or George Herbert or you name it, or Shakespeare.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your phone call. Here is John now in Portland, Oregon, that is, listening on the Great Modern Day Radio. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, hello, guys. I have a dear friend of mine who has moved to Italy. And by moving to Italy as a Protestant with his longtime great wife, and I've known him since high school, he has met a zealous, well-known PhD, you know, trained anti-Catholic that's based there out of Rome. And he just sent me his book and sent me his letter, and he's just zealous about, you know, that thing. And I won't mention his name, but I just don't know how am I supposed to love him when he's so entrapped with this kind of Protestantism now?
Yeah, well, I think you just put your finger on it. I think you used the right word, entrapment. And it's one thing for a person to hold Protestant belief, or Catholic belief for that matter.
Yeah.
It's another thing for a person to be an ideologue who can't relate to other human beings except through the lens of their ideological hammer that they hit you over the head with continually. And if someone, you know, believes that God is a McDonald's hamburger and they keep it to themselves, well, I'd feel rather bad for them that they had such a diminutive deity, but, you know, I wouldn't find it personally offensive to me if, as long as they, you know, didn't accuse me of, I don't know, worshiping a tuna fish or something. So it's when they come at me with, you know, well, you've got to worship the mystic hamburger with me, that I would begin to take offense and say, like, you keep your hamburger to yourself, buddy, you know.
Yeah.
But when people are ideologically possessed, usually they are so for a reason. I don't know your friend's case, but this is a common reason. Any ideology, whether it's religious or political or conspiratorial, has a tendency to wrap reality up in a neat little box and to tie all the pieces together and to present a tightly coherent picture of reality. It usually requires accepting a few premises that can't be proven, but if you just grant me X, grant me this premise, I can explain the rest of reality to you. And that's a very attractive intellectual stance to take for many, many people. I used to be very much like that. That was put together in such a way that I thought, you know, I needed an intellectual system to explain reality. And it has a couple benefits psychologically to the one that holds it. One is it reduces uncertainty tremendously because you have an answer for everything, fits within your system. And we are not naturally comfortable with uncertainty. Uncertainty is a danger to us. You know, we have to come up with ways of coping with uncertainty. And if I can explain away uncertainty, then I have a certain kind of psychological confidence and I can remove some existential angst by doing that. It also makes me feel special. And this, I think, is another huge motive, right? Because if you are in possession of the system, then you have the keys to knowledge that your benighted neighbors lack. And so it has kind of the appeal of esotericism about it, because I know the secret, and let me enlighten you. And here I am, a person of wisdom, and you need what I've got, and I can tell you the truth and then get you into my club and so forth. And it makes you feel important because you can, you know, you can look down on all the people, the ignorant people that don't really know that, you know, Congress is made up of lizard people from Alpha Centauri. And I think both of these things, very understandable, but they proceed from a deep kind of insecurity, ultimately, and they involve a deep kind of irrationality. There's a difference between being highly intelligent and being highly rational. Many people who are advocates of conspiracy theories and other ideologies are very intelligent people. That's why they're able to hold all these disparate ideas in their mind and spill out these elaborate justifications for them. But they're not rational because they hold them in a way that is immune to evidence, that's immune to contradiction. They're not willing to contemplate other ways of framing reality, and so they shut down and refuse to look at contrary points of view. Well, I mean, you know from the scientific enterprise that if you follow that route, you never make any progress, right? Science is all about disproving, disconfirming some hypothesis. You never know for sure that something is right, but you can, you know, you can accept or reject the null hypothesis based on the testing conditions, and that's what you do. You always look for grounds to, you know, to well, I said not accept, but to reject or to fail to reject, I should put it that way, the null hypothesis. And St. Thomas says that one of the integral parts of prudence is docility, like the willingness to be taught, you know. So if I provide you evidence that Congress is not made up of lizard people, the rational thing is to look at the evidence and revise your theory accordingly. So I look at somebody like that as someone who is entrapped, right? They are entrapped. They're entrapped in the logic of a theory to palliate what is, in essence, you know, kind of a bruised ego or a sense of insecurity in the world. And if I am not likewise insecure, then I can love them knowing that I am immune to that particular error, not their specific ideology,
yeah,
but to the kind of way of being in the world where I need to have an intellectual system that answers every question for me. I'm open to mystery, in other words, and I can tolerate that. They can't tolerate that, and that's a shame, all right? So I think you can approach them with compassion and love, and you can be unthreatened and not feel the need to do to him what he's doing to you. You don't have to prove to him the truth of your Catholic system, right? Because you don't have that insecurity. And you leave him in the providence of God, and you just love on him. And, you know, if he becomes completely intolerable, you can just, you know, laugh and slap him on the back and say, buddy, you know, God love you, I love you, I'm really not interested. Can we just talk about tennis?
Mm. John, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, it very much is. I mean, I'll just pray for him, but he sent me the guy's book, said he met him and, you know,
sure,
got his PhD from King's College in England and is popular there, and he met him, shook his hand, got a signed book. And
well, isn't that
nice? Reading the back of the book. I know. And I'm reading the back of the book. Like, I mean, just one of the lines is, you know, do these Catholics, do they love Jesus? I'm like rolling my eyes.
You know, I have another idea for you, John. Get your friend to call me. I'd love to get him on the air. Get your friend to call me and tell me what he loves about this guy, and he can ask me if I love Jesus and what do I think that means, and we can let him, we can talk himself silly, and we'd love to talk to him.
John, thanks so much.
Okay,
for
I will.
All
I will.
Right. Thank you so much for your phone call from Portland, call to communion here on EWTN. Are you saying that's not true about Congress and lizard people? Are you saying that's not true?
I didn't say that wasn't
okay.
True. Did I say that wasn't true?
We're going to leave it right there. Nicholas called in from Long Island, and he couldn't stay on hold, but he did ask this question. Dr. Anders, I'm dating an atheist. How should I proceed, especially if she turns out to not be as friendly to the idea of Catholicism as I might hope?
Yeah, I would sort of think you ought to lead with that. You know, I mean, like if Catholicism is an important part of your identity, I think I'd put on my dating profile, warning, Catholicism, important part of my identity.
Yeah.
Catholic haters need not apply. Right. I mean, like, seriously, that would be a deal breaker. You know, you don't have to marry a Catholic. But I mean, I don't see if your Catholic identity is important to you, like, why would you want to get intimate with somebody who absolutely hates your identity? Right. If you put it on your shirt sleeve and they can't stand that, they're going to leave you anyway, right?
Yeah.
You're not obligated by the Catholic Church to only marry Catholics, and you can marry a non-Christian. You can have a natural marriage, not a sacramental marriage. You have a natural marriage with a non-Christian. But you know, you get around to having children, you're going to have to raise questions about how are they going to be raised? Are they going to be raised in the church? You might not have their enthusiastic endorsement, but you can't really have their active opposition and raise kids in the church. So I would get this front and center and say, hey, I'm Catholic. That's important to me. You know, I respect your conscience, but is that a problem for you? And lead with that.
Nicholas, thanks for listening to us on Long Island. In a moment, we'll talk with Catherine, first-time caller from Texas, Callie in Yuma, Arizona, Steve in Melbourne, Florida, and believe it or not, still a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We are live on this Thursday afternoon on Call to Communion from EWTN. Busy day on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN's Call to Communion, but there's still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN, and there's a line available for you right now, 833-288-3986. Here is Steve in Melbourne, Florida, listening on one of our great partners, the wonderful Divine Mercy Radio in Melbourne. Hello, Steve. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Anders, and I read in the Bible on in John 5, I believe it's verse 24, where Jesus is saying that no man has seen or has seen God's form or heard God's voice. And, of course, throughout the Bible, you know, like for Abraham has heard God's voice, et cetera. What is the interpretation there?
So in the context of John 5, I think your point is still valid, but I think we have to go to another verse. In the context of John 5, Jesus says to his contemporary audience, and this is not a universal statement, you have never heard his voice or seen his form. Because he says, you do not believe in the one he has sent. So that's obviously restricted to that particular audience. He's not talking to us because we believed in the one that he sent.
Sure, right?
So that's
sure.
a different category. But if you go back to John chapter 1, verse 18, I think you can still have the same problem, which is no one has ever seen God. That's what John 1:18 says. So what do you do with the Old Testament? Well, the standard theological explanation is that God, for instance, is not a burning bush. God's not a burning bush. Now, Moses saw a burning bush. God spoke to him out of a burning bush. What is that if it's not God? Well, it's what we call a theophany. It's a theophany. You know, in internet land, you know, it's not uncommon for people to have a little image that represents them when they go online and interact with other people, and they borrow a term from Hindu mythology. They call it an avatar.
Yes.
You know, that's my avatar, right? And I don't want to, the phraseology is unfortunate because I'm not trying to invoke Hinduism, but I am invoking the idea of its use in the internet of a sign or a symbol that stands for you in your public interactions. Something like that is how Catholic theologians understood these images that appear in the Old Testament that are identified with God. We call them theophanies. They are appearances of the divine. They are not the divine per se. They are not the essence of God per se. Hence, Moses' experience on Mount Horeb when he says, I want to see your face, God. And God says, well, no one can see my face and live. I'll show you my back. And then he puts Moses Moses in the cleft of the rock and covers the hand.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in Elijah calls down fire from heaven on the prophets of Baal. Then he runs away to Mount Carmel and goes up on top of Mount Carmel, and he sits there in prayer. And then a pillar of fire comes by, a strong wind comes by, an earthquake comes by, and we're told explicitly, God, not in the fire, not in the earthquake, not in the wind. And then there's a very ambiguous Hebrew phrase that some people translate, still small voice. That's not actually what it says, but something interior without form manifests, and Elijah recognizes it, the presence of God. But it's evidently not any sensible sign, right? So there's a differentiation there made between these theophanies, these tangible appearances of signs of power that are tokens of God, but not God himself.
Steve, thanks for checking in from Melbourne, Florida. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Great email that came in a couple of days ago. This will make you smile, David. He says, this is from Elizabeth Ann. Dr. Anders, you are a wealth of information. Your show has been so helpful. My parents, who are in their 70s, are coming into the Catholic Church this Easter after having been Protestants their entire lives. So, what advice do you have for them in preparing for their first confession? How does one go about a first-time, lifetime, general confession at their age?
Yeah, so remember, you are not obligated to confess every sin you've ever committed. You're not even obligated to confess every mortal sin you've ever committed. You are obligated to confess every mortal sin that you can remember.
Ah.
And it is often the case that if there is some sin in our lives that we may have done it more than once because we're lumping them into categories,
yeah.
you know, according to kind, you don't have to say, you know, well, I committed murder on April the 2nd, 1971, and then I committed murder again on April the 3rd, 1971. And, you know, if you lose track, it's enough to say, you know, I was an assassin for the mob and I killed a lot of people. But that's horrible, and I'm very sorry. And I don't remember how many, and I don't remember where, and I don't remember when. But I did this one thing multiple times under these circumstances, and I'm really sorry about that. So kind in number is really all you have to say. And if you don't know the number, you just go a lot, you know, more than five or whatever. And that kind of narrows the field a lot. Right? Now, sometimes people want to go in a little bit more granular detail as a kind of act of catharsis, but it's not actually necessary for the validity of the sacrament.
All right. Elizabeth Ann, thank you so much for your delightful email. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Angela in Vermont, listening on Our Lady of Perpetual Help Radio. Hello, Angela. What's on your mind today?
Hi. So I've been watching, within the past month, I've been interested in watching some of these NDE near-death experiences. And then over the past weekend, some of them have come up that they've talked about the 3 days of darkness. Can you explain any of that stuff to me? Because I'm getting a little confused.
Yeah, sure. So there is a popular tradition, very small T tradition, within Catholicism, alleging that certain Catholic visionaries promised this event sometime in the apocalyptic future. And when the whole world turns black and only beeswax-blessed candles will work and people's sins will be revealed and, you know, very, very like Book of Revelation kind of stuff here, except that it's not in the Book of Revelation, right? But the allegation is that different Catholic visionaries have made this kind of prediction. So there's a kind of a popular undercurrent of folks that buy into that. Now, it's conspicuous to me that no pope has ever publicly endorsed this idea. No bishop that I'm aware of has publicly endorsed this idea. Your local Catholic parish, they're not giving out blessed candles to prepare you for this. You know, I mean, it's just not part of Catholic magisterial teaching or culture or spirituality in any way. It is very much a kind of a, you know, an underground sub-Catholic fascination that some people have. You're certainly not obligated to hold it. I personally advise against holding it because I think it breeds paranoia. A kind of an apocalyptic orientation to the end of time tends to detract us from our present duties of our state of life and genuine social concern. I mean, this is what I found growing up in highly apocalyptic Protestantism. If you're so oriented towards this horribly catastrophic end of the world that's imminently around the corner, then, like, you know, what do you need to worry about poverty for? What do you need to worry about, say, do the Palestinians have water rights?
Yeah.
Not always is the problem. The answer is
right.
An answer to that question.
Like, right.
How do you get involved in concrete problems that people have to try to better their life and engage in what the church calls integral development? So that's their economic well-being, their social well-being, their political well-being, their familial well-being, their physical well-being, their mental and emotional, and above all, their spiritual well-being. Like, how do you engage, and this is what we're supposed to be doing, in the integral good of peoples and their development? If you're obsessed with this, you know, you think that social ministry means handing out candles. Right? No,
yeah.
It means a lot more than that. You know, it means educating people and advocating for peace and getting involved in public policy and all these things that we need to make a better world. And you're distracting yourself with this apocalyptic fear that I think is oftentimes driven by a kind of desire to be part of an elite little group. You know, we're the few Illuminati that understand the real secret. And, you know, it's a lot easier to give out candles than it is to solve the problem of Palestinian water rights. And so it gives me a way to feel like I'm accomplishing something grand in the cosmological scheme of things, but I'm really accomplishing very little except cutting myself off from rational engagement with the love of my neighbor. All this is a result of alleged private revelations. And private revelation in Catholic teaching is not the public teaching of the church, and very few private revelations get public approbation from the church. And even when they do, it doesn't obligate Catholics to believe. It just tells them they're allowed to. Those are things like Our Lady of Fatima or Our Lady of Lourdes or Our Lady of Guadalupe. And there's a small handful of approved apparitions, but this kind of thing doesn't fall into that category. With respect to near-death experiences, they are also allegations of private revelation. You will find Catholic apologists that are all gung-ho on near-death experiences. Some at EWTN, in particular, Father Robert Spitzer, he is the near-death experience guy, you know, and he's very smart. He's a lot smarter than I am. And if you want to read a Catholic apologist that takes a very positive view of near-death experiences, get a hold of Robert Spitzer and his Magus Center, and you'll find all kinds of stuff about them that he advocates. I don't necessarily take that approach myself. From a global perspective, my view is that near-death experiences contradict one another with respect to the next life, and they give accounts that often kind of confirm what they're sort of cultural expectations would be. And sometimes they don't really line up well with what sacred tradition says. So I'm not all that impressed by them. I don't have a good scientific explanation for what's going on because that's not my field, but my ignorance is not proof of their truth.
Angela, thanks so much for your call from Vermont. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. We can probably squeeze in a few more phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. This week, here on the network, on both radio and television, we've been doing a lot of thinking and contemplating about the life of our foundress mother, Angelica, who passed away, hard to believe, 10 years ago tomorrow. It is unbelievable.
Oh, wow.
On March 27th, 2016, it was actually Easter Sunday, if you'll recall, David. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
And remains a big deal to an awful lot of us. Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Eastern, that will be celebrated during the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. We'll also have some special programming for you lined up throughout the day on EWTN radio and television. So please do keep it right here. Let's go now to Joan in Aurora, Colorado, listening on the Great Catholic Radio Network. Hello, Joan. What's on your mind today?
And it's fun with the luncheon.
Joan, are you there?
You don't have to head up a lunch.
Joan, are you there with us?
But I did. And
why don't we put Joan on hold? I think she's listening to the radio, which could be a little bit confusing. Here's a question now from Patrick in Jackson, Michigan. Patrick says he is a part of the Arise group in our parish. Our group was wondering what books you could recommend about angels for this group. Thanks, Pat in Jackson, Michigan.
Wow, I really appreciate the question. I apologize. I am not just filled with bibliography on angels. I am just not full of bibliography on angels. I mean, when I want to know about angels, I just go read the section of the Summa Theologica, St. Thomas the Summa, that deals with the angels. It gives me all the doctrinal stuff I need to know. You know, it's written in scholastic language and it's highly technical. So it's, you know, people generally like a bit more fluff in their angels. They like some personality in their angels. They like some angel stories. They like things that edify them at that level. And that's definitely not St. Thomas. But I like to read St. Thomas on angels if I'm going to read them. It tells me what an angel is, what an angel does, how are they ranked and ordered, you know, what's the nature of their intellect, what's the nature of their motion, how can they interact with human beings. That's the kind of stuff I read. It's kind of short on sensational stories, but that's the best I can give you right now.
Joan, thanks so much for your question there. Actually, that was not Joan. We're going to get to Joan in just a moment. That was actually a question from Pat in Jackson, Michigan. Now we're going to go to Jerry, a first-time caller from Hannibal, Missouri, home of Mark Twain, and listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I understand. Well, I'd like to know more about the four main cults of Christianity. I think Mormonism and Jehovah's Witness are two. And what are the other two, and why are they cults?
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the question. So sometimes, and these are not categories that are in any way officially taught by the Catholic Church. So you're not going to find a pope or a bishop saying, you know, here are the official four cults of, you know, branched off from the Christian tradition. Honestly, I don't like that language personally. And the reason I don't like it is that Christianity as a movement, as an historical force, has always been diverse. The Catholic Church has always held itself to be the measuring rod of Christian faith, that this is the church founded by Jesus.
Uh-huh.
And that defections from it are defections from the Church Christ founded, but to say that there's just four major deviations, I don't think that is true to history. I mean, like, there have been thousands and thousands of non-Catholic movements over the years that differ from the Catholic Church in greater or lesser ways. You know, if you included the tens of thousands of Christian denominations, Protestant denominations in that, I mean, the number would, you'd have to get an encyclopedia to cover all Christian movements that are not Catholicism. Now, some of these movements have veered, you know, exceedingly far off the Catholic path, And again, this didn't start in the modern era, so some of the ancient heresies like Marcionism or Gnosticism, Novationism, and especially Arianism and later Nestorianism, Monophysitism, I mean, we could just go on and on and on. I mean, there's a whole list of medieval heresies. Chief among them would be the Manichaean, not the Manichaean, the Albigensian heresy, or the Cathars, you know, the Hussites in Bohemia. I mean, again, just on and on and on and on and on. I think the motive for classing these four, and I know the four, and I'm going to give them to you in a second. The motive for classing them comes not so much from Catholic ecclesiology, but from modern Protestant ecclesiology. Let me explain what I mean. In classical Protestant history, 16th century Protestants believed, like the Catholic Church believes, that there is but one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. And so they regarded anything that wasn't them as heretical. Luther clearly thought that. He thought that other Protestants were hell-bound heretics because they didn't agree with him. Calvin thought the same way. Calvin thought that if you didn't agree with Calvin, you were a hell-bound heretic, right? 200 years into Protestantism, when the main branches of the Lutheran branch, the Calvinist branch, the Episcopalian branch, the Anabaptists and others, and then later on Baptists and various Puritan sects, as those groups continued to fail to agree, there emerged a new Protestant ecclesiology that I will call denominationalism. And the idea in denominationalism was there is a kind of a core of Christian doctrines that all the quote-unquote real Christians believe in, and that's where we're going to draw the dividing line. And as long as you hold these doctrines, we don't care if you differ from us on sacraments or church government. They just sort of redefined what Catholicity means around a smaller group of doctrines. That would enable them to recognize one another as quote-unquote real Christians. And then that way they can, you know, say, well, here are the few Christian groups that don't hold what we call essentials. And I think you see why, for a Catholic, that's wrongheaded. Because there is a definite body of Christian truth that the Catholic Church teaches, and everybody else could be ranked as nearer or farther from that, right? So we're not trying to draw a big tent and say everybody in this tent is a Christian and everybody outside the tent is an occult. That's not the way we look at it. We sort of look at the universe itself as a tent, and here's Catholic truth, and then everybody has some degree, you know, of greater or lesser Christian truth, right?
Sure.
But if you're going to draw that line the way Protestants draw it, they would typically identify Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Christian Scientists, and Seventh-day Adventists.
Okay.
That'd be the way they would handle it. But again, this is not a Catholic category system.
Okay. Jerry, thanks so much for your call from Hannibal. Here now is Joan in Aurora, Colorado, listening on the Great Catholic Radio Network. Hey, Joan, what's on your mind today? Joan, are you there? Joan in Colorado, are you there? Joan is not there.
Joan's not there.
Bye, Joan. Here's a question now from Chris and Ryan in Wallingford, Connecticut. They say, our 16-year-old son, who also likes to listen to your program, brought this up on the drive into school this morning. It seems unfair that one diocese can declare a holy day of obligation while another can remove the requirement to attend Mass. A specific example is how the Feast of the Assumption, August 15th, is not a holy day of obligation everywhere. It seems unfair that one person can be subject to mortal sin by not attending, while others don't have that obligation solely because of a diocesan decision. We didn't have a great answer for him except to say that we do owe our church our obedience, and that extends to the local church as well. But we did agree that we'll send the question to Dr. Anders. Love your show. Chris and Ryan in Wallingford, Connecticut.
You know, thank you. I appreciate the question. When I was a kid, my best friend in grammar school and I used to have a lot of sleepovers. I'd sleep over at his place, he'd sleep over at my place. Sometimes we would get a tent and our parents would drop us off in the woods and we'd sleep in the woods in a, you know, third location. We just hung out all the time. We'd go fishing, we'd go swimming, we'd go camping, and we would, you know, build forts in our basements and beat each other up with pillows, and we had all kinds of fun. You know, we just did this all through grammar school. And my parents typically were, not in the political sense, but in the parental sense, kind of liberal in the way, in that they were kind of easy, you know, go lucky with respect to making plans. You know, I could call 5 minutes before the time and say, hey, you know, mom, so-and-so has invited me over. They want me there in the next half hour. Can I go? Yeah, sure. Let me put down this thing I'm working on. I'll drive you over. Like, it was kind of easy. It's just, whatever you want to do, that's fine. We'll help you do it. My buddy's family, however, had a really strict rule. You are obligated to refuse any invitation that comes fewer than 24 hours in advance. So if I called him at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and said, do you want to come over tonight? It didn't matter if they had nothing on their calendar. If I hadn't asked on Thursday, the answer was always no.
Really?
Always no. Categorically no. Just because you waited till, quote unquote, the last minute to ask.
Okay.
They just had a rule, you can never ask at the last minute. I didn't have to follow that rule in my house. My buddy did have to follow that rule in his house. Those were not my parents. I had to respect his family's rule.
Yeah.
My family didn't have that rule because his parents were his parents and my parents were my parents. My parents had different rules for me. I think you can see in the case of families have the right to run their own family life according to their own principles, you know, provided their motives are for the good of their family and the good of their children and for family order or whatever reason, non-arbitrary reason they had. That's fine because they're his parents, not mine, and my parents are my parents, not his. Very much the same logic applies with diocese. That the bishop is the pastor, the father figure of the people in his geographical diocese. And the reason that the church divides into dioceses the way it does, one very practical reason is, you know, granted, the Diocese of Birmingham, Alabama, and Montgomery, Alabama, might not differ that much, although I think our friends in Mobile would, I said Montgomery, I meant to say Mobile. I think our friends in Mobile would probably differ. Oh, no, we're really different from you Birmingham people, right? But from my perspective, we don't differ that much. But I think that the Catholic Diocese of Birmingham and the Catholic Diocese of Tehran differ a lot.
Yeah.
In culture, in law, in, you know, political expediency, and in weather. I mean, all kinds of factors come into play. That means that you have got to have some kind of freedom of action where the local ordinary can you know, monkey about a bit with people's adherence to the faith and their obligations, because who knows what's coming down the pike? In the United States, in the last couple of years, some of the bishops in dioceses, very large dioceses that have just enormous undocumented immigrant populations, relaxed the Sunday Mass obligation for people who were, you know, afraid for their lives or families or for deportation or something. And they said, okay, if that's your situation in this diocese, you know, you're exempt from your Sunday obligation. Well, that wouldn't make a lot of sense for, say, the Archdiocese of Mexico City.
Right.
Right? I mean, so you have to have that kind of freedom of action over those kinds of things.
Chris and Ryan, thanks so much for your question from Connecticut. We did get Joan's question. You remember she called and couldn't get her on. Here's her question. I am 70 and dating an unbaptized man. Can you recommend a book or two to give to him so he could learn as much as he can, but simply about Catholicism?
Yeah, John Trigilio's Catholicism for Dummies.
Thinking of the same thing. In fact, I just bought a copy of Catholicism for Dummies for a dear friend of mine that I've known since, I think I talked about this earlier, since high school. And I said, have I got a book for you? It lays it out very simply. So
that's great.
That is any other recommendations you might make,
you know,
along those lines?
Because I don't know this guy, you know, that's probably like the most approachable lowbrow thing I've got. The other recommendation would be not a book at all, but at that time, Father Robert Barron's Catholicism series that was produced for public television.
Yeah.
but is available, you know, on DVD and other avenues. Yeah. It's just a beautiful introduction to the beauty of the church and its antiquity that's visual and for somebody who is motivated that way.
And by the way, I just finished reading the book that that was based on.
Yeah.
It is a very good book. So there you go, a couple of good resources for you. Joan, thank you so much for checking in with us today. Hey, Dr. David Andrews, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
We do it right here on EWTN Radio five times a week, we'll put it that way, at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check out the recording of today's program. Pedro will have that posted for you in the next couple of hours. EWTN.com/listen. EWTN.com/listen. Hey, you'll find a lot of great stuff there. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thank you for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Have a great day. God bless.